Hello and welcome to Martian Drive-In Podcast number 71. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I am celebrating Yucktober. Yucktober every year is now going to be the time of year when the Martian Drive-In Podcast looks at bad movies. And to celebrate the very first Yucktober Martian Drive-In Podcast, I'm going to look at two bad films. The first one is a Disney film from 1962, and it is Moon Pilot, starring, amongst other people, Tom Tryon, Danny Saville, Edmund O'Brien, and Brian Keith. And from there we go on to a recommendation from one of the Patreon subscribers to the podcast, and that is for a totally crazy movie that a lot of people have a lot of time for. And that, of course, is the 1974 science fiction movie Zardoz, starring Sean Connery and Charlotte Rampling, Sarah Kesselman. So we're going from Disney to nudity, from Disney to John Borman. So sit back, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and we will get this puppy started. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Hi, how's everybody going? Last night I went out to dinner. I had a proper grown-up dinner party with friends. So we went out to our friend Jamie and Sarah's place and had an enormous dinner party with 18 people. A lot of good people were there. There was Kirsten McDermott from the Writer and the Critic podcast. A bunch of other people I knew. Lucy Sussex was there with Julian Warner. A bunch of really intelligent and fun people. So it was great to hang out. We had some thunderstorms come through at night. We dined on a three-course meal, which included roasted goat from a spit roast out the back. And it was all just really wonderful. But what it did was we didn't get home till 1 o'clock in the morning. So I had to get up this morning and get everything ready. I still had to watch one of the movies for the podcast. It was a lot of running around. And then, because I'm insane at times, I went and assembled the new bookshelves that I bought, well, the new shelves I bought for the Blu-ray collection. And that took me about 3 hours of bending over and nailing and screwing and bolting and all sorts of things in pretty hot and humid weather. So I'm physically a bit exhausted at the moment, but I'm going to persevere. We're going to get the podcast done. Please don't worry about that. But yeah, and the Blu-ray shelf looks pretty damn good now. All of the Blu-rays are in one place. They're all more or less in alphabetical order, basically by letter. I haven't got them in subcategories like, but I've just got it done as letters. I may mess around with it later. I may not. But I can at least find things now. So that's kind of good. And it means that I can move the remainder of the DVDs to where the Blu-rays were in the man cave. The shelf for the Blu-rays is outside the man cave, so it's more accessible for Sally to get the stuff. And, yes, I've been really, really active. And, therefore, I ache in a lot of places that I shouldn't ache if I were looking after myself a lot better. But I'm going to have to try to do that over the summer. That's my determination, is to look after myself a bit better over the summer. So I hope you're all doing okay. Lots of weird shit going on in the world, and I'm not going to talk about any of it because this is all about the movies. So I've decided to institute Yucktober, which October every year, the Martian Drive-In Podcast is going to look at bad genre films. And by bad, I don't mean, you know, really, 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 really shit movies that nobody should ever watch under any circumstances, but flawed and kind of icky movies in some ways. And I do include Zardoz in that because it's a bit of a dog's breakfast in some ways. But nonetheless, Yucktober, so this podcast and the next one, I'm going to deliberately find unsuccessful genre films to talk about, just as a little bit of a change. I know a lot of people are doing Halloween and stuff like that, but Halloween, even though it is gaining in popularity here in Australia, really hasn't kicked in as much as it has in America and other places. So I think Yucktober is my kind of alternative to that. So as usual, I'm going to talk about the stuff I've been watching lately. There haven't been a lot of movies because a lot of TV shows are coming back. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. have come back, and Arrow and Flash and all of those kind of vulgar pleasures that I have as far as movie watching is concerned, so I've been doing a lot of that. But I have watched a few genre films. I did see a movie which is more well known for its remake than for the movie itself. And that's a little aeroplane drama from the 1950s, I think from 1957, called Zero Hour, starring Dana Andrews, Linda Darnell, and Sterling Hayden. It's about, and this may sound familiar to you, it's about an airline flight where everybody on the plane, well, half of the people on the plane pretty much, come down with food poisoning, including the two pilots. So a World War II pilot suffering pretty much from PTSD, played by Dana Andrews, has to take over and land the aeroplane. Now, if that sounds familiar, it's the plot and a lot of the same characters from Airplane, also known as Flying High, the Zucker Brothers movie from the 1970s. And this is the original thing on which that movie was based. So I thought I'd go back and watch the original. And, yeah, it's a lot more serious. Well, of course it's a lot more serious, but it's very kind of serious, fairly low budget. But not without features of interest. I mean, some of the characters even have the same names. You've got the Doctor character in there. You've got Dana Andrews playing Ted Stryker, the pilot. And, yeah, it's a really interesting comparison to Airplane. So I watched that, and that was a lot of fun to do. Now, I haven't watched anything else really apart from the two movies for this podcast, so that's going to be a very short what I've been watching lately. But I have been watching the beginning seasons of all of those TV things, and I've also gone back to something that I do now and then, and which is a kind of relaxing thing in some ways, and you may well do the same thing, I don't know, but that's watching trailer compilations. Online in particular, and on disc, you can get lots and lots of exploitation movie trailers linked together on one disc or in one file, and you just sit back and watch them and maybe try to find the movies if they pique your interest. But when I kind of want to turn off the brain, I often watch trailer compilations, and I've been doing a little bit of that as well. But anyway, I'm going to take a break, and when I get back, we're going to talk about the first of these two movies, which is the 1962 fairly low budget for Disney movie, live action, called Moon Pilot, starring Tom Tryon, Danny Saval, Brian Keith, and Edmund O'Brien.
Seven times. Seven times a charm.
That, of course, is The Seven Moons of Beta Lyrae, sung by Danny Saville and Tom Tryon, from the 1962 Disney comedy Moon Pilot. So I went back and took a look at the Biographical Dictionary of Film, and the first paragraph of the notation on Walt Disney is really amusing. David Thompson did a fantastic job on this. There have been plenty of books on Disney and the world he made, and there will be more. He is one of the great American subjects, the unholy mix of artist and businessman, the slender soul who exerts enormous influence, a giant of movies, yet one of its betrayers, and the Pied Piper to 50 years of American children whose extraordinary insistence on fantasy has come to change the look of the land and the jungle of suburbia. In the career of Walt Disney, one may see the passage from a culture of comic books to that of computer-generated imagery. He makes God seem a little slow and old-fashioned. And here's a little bit more, which is kind of pertinent too. From cradle to college, Disney had possession of kids. There were protests, but we are reaping the rewards in so many ways as adult films become more childish. Now, that's pretty much a kind of condemnation of Disney, but a recognition of the influence he had on a certain kind of cinema in the 1950s and 1960s predominantly, and well into the 1970s. So Moon Pilot was a lowish budget Disney film, which kind of satirized NASA and the space race and all that kind of thing, but not in any kind of pointed way. It was a very soft satire, a very broad, very kind of spongy and mushy kind of satire. At the start of Moon Pilot, there's a satire about the fact that America sent chimps up into space before they ever sent men. This movie was made only a year after Freedom 7, when Alan Shepard became the first American to orbit the Earth. So it's still got a little bit of that flavor of America being unsuccessful in space. You've got to remember, before Alan Shepard and before the Mercury program, a lot of the rockets that America sent up crashed and failed spectacularly. The Russians, as far as their boosters were concerned, were much more successful. By the time Alan Shepard got up there, the Russians had already got Yuri Gagarin up there, and Valentina Tereshova, the first woman in space, had already circled the Earth before Alan Shepard got there. So in stark contradiction to the stuff that he did a few years earlier with Man in Space on the Disney television show, Disney decided to make Moon Pilot, which is a very weird movie for a number of reasons, partly because it's very difficult to know what the target audience is for this film. It's a little too dumbed down, and the comedy is way too broad for an adult audience. And it's not really aimed at children. It doesn't have a lot of the aspects of a comedy satire that would appeal to children. All of the people in it, with one tiny exception, are adults and the chimps. It's a lovey-dovey romance in some ways, which is never attractive to particularly young boys. And it doesn't have too much of the fantastic aspect of things to kind of keep it interesting from that point of view as well. It's neither fish nor fowl. It's in that weird alternate universe Twilight Zone that they used to call wholesome entertainment, which is a terrible thing. Now, the characters in the film are kind of cliched. Well, cliched would be the best word for it. I could use a lot of other words, most of which probably wouldn't get on American commercial television. Tom Tryon was an actor who had previously done a bit of genre work. He was the husband in I Married a Monster from Outer Space and had just done a number of TV episodes for the Disney TV series, playing a character called Texas John Slaughter, who was an ex-Confederate soldier who became a Texas Ranger and had various kind of white bread adventures around that. on the TV series. So he plays Captain Richmond Talbot, who's an Air Force pilot, but he's an Air Force officer who is scared of heights, doesn't like flying, and is kind of a milquetoast, nebbishy, soft guy who, you know, he's very fond of his mother and all of that kind of thing. He's a weakling in a lot of ways, even though he's played by Tom Tryon, who was tall, athletic, suntanned, and totally at odds with that kind of thing. It's a movie that would have suited a Don Knotts kind of actor rather than Tom Tryon. So you've got miscasting in the lead role. I'll leave aside Lyra, the alien girl who he meets, for a moment and talk about some of the other characters. There's a little cameo by Tommy Kirk playing Walter Talbot, his brother, as Richmond visits home again. There's one scene with his brother played by Tommy Kirk, who was a kind of Disney favourite and had done a number of Disney movies earlier, but was kind of out of favour with Disney for a couple of reasons. Unfortunately, he did have some alcohol problems, and also he was gay. Now, the interesting thing here is, so was Tom Tryon. So they're playing brothers in driving around in a sports car, two closeted gay actors in the early 1960s. Then we have the kind of comic relief authority figures in the movie. First one's Major General Vanneman, played by Brian Keith. Brian Keith, very fine character actor. If you look at some of the early roles Brian Keith did in the 50s, really good character actor. He had the chops to do things. And particularly in movies like Jacques Tourneur's Nightfall, for instance, and Hivero, a nice little kind of South American set movie, which also starred Fernando Lamas. He was a good, honest character actor who knew his chops. Interesting thing about him is that his stepmother was Peg Entwistle. Peg Entwistle was famous. She was a kind of minor starlet in the 1920s and 1930s, I think. But the thing she's most famous for is she committed suicide by jumping off the Hollywood sign. And she was Brian Keith's stepmother. So there you go. But Brian Keith, one of those actors who wore a rug a lot. You can tell that's a wig in this movie because any movie you see him in 5 years earlier, his hairline's a bit further back. But in this one, he plays Major General Vanneman and spends the entire movie shouting and yelling and acting like somebody that you would not let near any kind of position of authority in any circumstance ever. He's a kind of guy that you would shoot with a taser if he came near you. This is what passed for comedy, having shouty generals telling people what to do and bossing around people and intimidating military officers. That's him. Then you've got an FBI agent who goes looking for Talbot when he goes missing. And he's played by Edmund O'Brien, another fine character actor. If you've ever seen The Barefoot Contessa, Edmund O'Brien is great in that. He was in DOA, one of the great public domain film noir films of the 1950s. And of course, he was in The Girl Can't Help It. So, you know, good character actor. He plays Mikulski, a kind of half-assed FBI agent. And again, lots of shouting involved. And lots of over-the-top comedy, which is supposed to be comedy anyway, but more comes across as people with poor impulse control. This movie is just full of that. It's full of lots of guys shouting at each other. It's not funny. That's one of the biggest criminal things about this movie is it's not funny at all. It's got an athletic and handsome guy playing a milquetoast. It's got two shouty character actors who are just cashing a check and need to know better. It's got a cameo by Tommy Kirk when he was on The Outer with Disney. And then into this they drop a fine French actress called Dani Saval, who's still alive and is married to a very famous television journalist in France. And she plays Lyrae, the girl from Beta Lyrae, who comes to Earth because they want to communicate with Earth and make friends with Earth, and comes down specifically to tell Talbot that they need to put a special metal lining on the space capsule, otherwise he'll go mad just the same way that the space chimp did. Yeah, the science here isn't great. And the movie doesn't seem to realise that Beta Lyrae is not a planet, it's actually a star. Actually, I misspoke, because Beta Lyrae is two stars. They're 960 light years away, and neither one of them is a star that's particularly hospitable to any kind of human life. Beta Lyrae A is a B7 star, which means it's very kind of hot, and the other one's not much less hot, and they spew out tons of ultraviolet light, and they're really not the kind of stars that you want to hang a planet around, particularly given that they're a binary star system, which always complicates the orbits of planets around them and all that kind of thing. So it's one of those names they may have picked out of an astronomy textbook and just didn't realize that, A, it's not a planet, and B, it's the last place in the universe you're going to find anything approaching human life. But nonetheless, Danny Saville in it is great. Now, I first saw this movie in the early 1960s with my uncles Roy and John. We were watching it on TV. It would have been black and white TV in Hammondville up in Sydney, in the house that my grandfather built after World War I. And we watched it, and the only thing that any of us liked was Danny Saville, because she was extremely beautiful. She had a French accent. She was the only person in this film who genuinely looked like she was having fun. And given all the rest of it's just shouty guys and Tom Tryon trying to play a role for which he's not suited at all, her in it is the fun part of the film. Watching her, and she's not in it all that long either. She comes in fairly late in the piece and starts a conversation with Talbot in an aeroplane, and then meets him later in San Francisco and does a little bit of magic. I mean, there's more magic than science in this film, where she projects into Talbot's future and shows him something from his future, which really helps the meet-cute process between Talbot and Lyrae. But, there are a few films like this, and it's a really interesting phenomenon where one of the actors knows what the film should be and the rest of them don't. And I think Danny Saville is that actor in Moon Pilot. She's the one who knows that this is supposed to be fun, supposed to be lighthearted, supposed to be a blancmange of a movie, a light confectionery. And the rest of them just don't get it. They're not playing it at the same level she is. She'd done a number of kind of ingenue roles in France before this, and she went on to do a number of other acting roles in the 1960s and into the 1970s as well. But the Disney organisation, with a singular lack of imagination, touted her as the new Brigitte Bardot. Now, Brigitte Bardot and Danny Saville have totally different acting styles and totally different personas in film. So it's a real kind of one of those stupid things that Disney did in promoting this stuff that really showed that even though they were tremendously successful at a certain kind of kid films, when it came to another kind of movie that they did, they were woefully tone deaf to what actually makes a good comedy. And one of the points that David Thompson makes in the new biographical dictionary of film, in the bit he does about Walt Disney, which I found really kind of interesting and really to the point as well, is that he said that Disney's biggest fault as a movie maker was the fact that he thought that there should be movies that are specifically for children. But Thompson gives a list of movies that he thinks that are perfectly suitable for children, but aren't specifically made for children in that sense. And the list is pretty good. The Secret Garden, Winchester 73, Renoir's The River, Scaramouche, Shane, Singing in the Rain, or The Glenn Miller Story, for instance. So he's taken movies that are ostensibly for adults but don't have too much adult material in them and said these are good movies for children. And I can definitely see his point. Making movies specifically for kids is something that movie makers are steering away from. The Pixar movies, for instance, don't do that. They make movies that are not don't have a lot of adult material in them, but are suitable for adults and children, which is one of the reasons why Pixar has been so successful, is that they have that bit, say, at the start of Up, where you find the history of the old couple. That kind of stuff, which kids will play along with, but is specifically designed for grown-ups, and show that the movie is a movie for all audiences. And the biggest fault with movies like this one, and there are any number of the live-action ones that were done in the 1960s by Disney, well, some of which starred Kurt Russell, for oddly enough, shows this, for a start, there's a weird nostalgia for the first half of the 20th century, particularly, say, anything before 1930, which is based on Disney's own worldview. And secondly, it's a false kind of picture postcard view of that time in history. And that's the reason why I found a movie like Saving Mr. Banks to be so repugnant. It was a hagiography of Disney in a lot of ways and really knocked P.L. Travers' ass into a tin can. And I didn't like that at all. I think that it was too careful and too respectful and too inaccurate to be a worthwhile movie. I didn't get all the way through it, even though it had Paul Giamatti and Emma Thompson in it, both of whom I have a lot of time for. Tom Hanks as well. I found that movie kind of repugnant and rewriting history in a very dishonest way. But anyway, to get back to Moon Pilot for a second, now that I've gone and eviscerated Walt Disney, the movie also has a number of very weird scenes in it. When they're searching for Lyra, the authorities are searching for her because, being a good little Air Force guy, Talbot's told them about this kooky chick that he met who says weird things. And so there's a scene of a police lineup where they grab kooky, weird women from San Francisco, where part of the movie is set, and have them in a lineup. And all of them are they're various beatnik types. And they're a bunch of women who, you know, they're eccentric and they're all wearing sweaters and glasses and have wild hairstyles. And it's an attempt in a really cack-handed way to satirize beatnik culture. And it makes these women incredibly unattractive. It's an incredibly misogynistic scene where a whole bunch of different women, they treat women who are poets or beatniks or just bohemian in general as if they're not only mentally retarded but basically mentally ill. And I found that whole scene cringeworthy. It was a very difficult scene to watch in the film. Oddly enough, one of them is an actor who was in her very first film role. It was actually Sally Field behind a pair of enormous glasses and a big woolly sweater declaiming poetry in the film. And of course, she went on to win Oscars and do all sorts of things, and oddly enough, worked with Tom Hanks a number of times. But this was her very first film role, and she's almost unrecognizable in there as one of these horrible harpies that they roll out for this totally unnecessary police lineup scene that they just used to fill time in a very threadbare script. So pretty much there are three things I like about this film. A, it's not that long. B, Danny Saville is very cute in it and really does lift the movie when she's in it. And it's a movie that definitely needs lifting. It's like a deflated dirigible just sitting there on the ground. And thirdly, I like the little song at the end that they sing in the spaceship as they're heading off the Beta Lyrae. I've got a lot of fondness for that, even though it makes no sense at all. It's just nonsense lyrics. It still has a tone to it that the rest of the movie singularly lacks. And I could see where they were, you know, they missed so many opportunities. It's one of those movies that's so annoying. You want to tear it down and rebuild it yourself and go, okay, here's a choice they could have made there that would have made it more interesting. And here's a way that this could have been played. And here's a way they could have got these fine character actors to play this much more interestingly, even though broadly comedically. It's a movie that should be torn down for spare parts. But that's one of the things about Disney that annoys me a lot. There was a time when they had moments of brilliance, and there are things like, and I've mentioned this in Paleo Cinema, the Three Caballeros, where there are immensely imaginative scenes in that movie, which are breathtaking combinations of live action and animation that really take the art form forward, and every time I watch them, I go, yeah, there's what they should have been doing. There are other Disney movies I have time for as well. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, I like that as well because It's got a steampunkness to it. It's got Kirk Douglas's over-the-top energetic performance. James Mason, you know, is pretty good as well. It's got Peter Lorre in it, which was another good choice. But overall, these kind of lesser Disney films are inexplicable to the 21st century eye. You go, why did they make this, and how did they make this, and who were the audience supposed to be for this film, and did they find it funny at the time? And was it successful? In this case, no. But there are, I got a couple of things out of it. One, I like the song, as I said. And two, I've got the movie poster for this movie, the Australian Day Bill lithograph poster of it, which is beautifully designed. The graphic designers who made that poster are geniuses. They're brilliant. It's so of its time, and it's so cool and groovy. I'm very happy I bought it, even though I did pay a fair bit for it. But I mean, you can always pick the little bits out of the film that are fine, but you can see it as a missed opportunity and one of those early iterations of that magic pixie dream girl kind of character in the character of Lyrae, played by Danny Saval. But her exuberant playing of it kind of makes it something that you can kind of forgive. But having said that, I'm going to end Moon Pilot now, and I probably won't watch it again for many, many years, if ever. But I will enjoy the poster, which I love because of the design on it and because of the fun of it. And then I'm going to take a break, and when we get back, we're going to talk about a movie from 12 years later in an entirely different movie realm. 12 years has put a lot of changes into the world, the 12 years between 1962 and 1974. The world evolved in weird ways and marvellous ones as well. And the crazy bug-fuck insanity of Zardoz is as good a demonstration of that as anything else is.
I am Arthur Frayne, and I am Zardoz. I have lived 300 years, and I long to die, but death is no longer possible. I am immortal. I present now my story, full of mystery and intrigue, rich in irony, and most satirical. It is set deep in a possible future, so none of these events have yet occurred. But they may. Be warned, lest you end as I. In this tale, I am a fake god by occupation, and a magician by inclination. Merlin is my hero. I am the puppet master. I manipulate many of the characters and events you will see. But I'm invented too for your entertainment and amusement. And you, poor creatures, who conjured you out of the clay? Is God in show business too?
That's an actor by the name of Niall Buggy, which is a really interesting and fun name for an actor, at the start of John Borman's pretentious 1974 science fiction movie Zardoz. In Zardoz, Sean Connery plays Zed, a brutal rapist who then spends, after having some adventures in the vortex where all of the immortal people live, ends up sitting around in a cave and having a kid with Charlotte Rampling and then dying. That's pretty much it. Everything in the middle, I'll tell you about in a moment. Here's how it happened. In 1973, John Borman made a spectacularly successful movie called Deliverance. It was really over-the-top successful, and so the Hollywood studios, being what they are, gave him $1 million and told him to go play with it. And so he went to Ireland in County Wicklow, which has some beautiful landscapes, and he made Zardoz. Originally, he was going to make it with Burt Reynolds as Zed, because both Burt Reynolds and Sean Connery had mustaches. But Burt Reynolds got sick, and so Sean Connery, who was at a bit of a loose end after making the James Bond films, agreed to do it for £200,000, which was a fifth of the budget. And so he went to the gym and decided that it was a good thing to play a guy who basically wears a bandolier and a red jockstrap for part of the film, dresses in bridal drag for another part of the film, and in general acts like somebody who really doesn't want to be there. So Zed is an exterminator who is out in the wilderness working for the big stonehead god Zardoz. Now, Zed and his fellow exterminators, their job is pretty much to rape women, shoot guys from horseback, and convince them to grow crops. But not necessarily in that order. The great stonehead god Zardoz spits out guns for the exterminators, and in return they get grain and produce and other things to enable the people who live within the safe zones known as vortexes to continue living. Now, the people in the vortexes are, and everybody's got a the, each group has got a the, so we have the exterminators in there. We also have the Eternals, who are the immortal people living in the vortices. We have a number of other groups as well who are these. We have the Brutals, who also live outside the vortex. As I said, we have the Eternals. We have the Renegades, who are renegade Eternals and who are punished by being aged. The Apathetics, who are catatonic Eternals. And then, of course, we have the Exterminators, who are the horseback riding, red jock strap wearing, sometimes Zardoz mask wearing police force for the wilderness. Apparently there are about 9 or 10 vortices around the place, though it's not really clear whether any of them aren't in the UK. I can't really see there being, say, a Chinese vortex or a Indigenous Australian one where they speak Yolnu, or one in Pacific Island like Tuvalu. It's a very Celtic future that they posit in this movie, and one that has the believability of a 3-year-old's lie. The world of Zardoz is one of the worst bits of world building you're going to see in a movie. They have a whole bunch of really nice ideas that they kind of slap together and hope they stick to each other. The Eternals have the ability to zap people's brains, kind of in a Daryl Revick, David Cronenberg Scanners kind of way, but nobody's head explodes. They just kind of roll around with migraines. And they also have the ability to form a group mind and to bully other people into submitting to their worldview. They have a number of other things. If they die violently, as indeed Arthur Freyn does at one stage in the film, there's a great big fish tank where they grow people again, so he'll come back to life at some stage, which he does as the film pans out. It's just one of those things where they've got a whole bunch of different ideas from, say, 1960s and 1970s New World magazine, the ones that were edited by people like Michael Moorcock, and they've thrown them all together. They've found a whole bunch of really nice buildings in County Wicklow and decided to put a whole bunch of weird things like baboon cages and great big inflatable domes near them to kind of essay a future. They have a lot of crystals as well. There's a crystal thing. And the ultimate computer, which is the one that controls everything, turns out to be a diamond about the size of a tennis ball. So you've got all of this stuff there which makes no real sense at all. There are some scenes in this movie of inexplicable length and inexplicable events. And it's just so monstrously and crazily pretentious. Even the amount of topless women in this movie don't really save it from being a what-the-fuck crazy and self-indulgently pretentious piece of filmmaking. And yes, though Sean Connery does his best with the film at times with his big long wig, ponytail wig, and his 1970s Fu Manchu mustache, he really does seem like he doesn't want to be there, and who can hardly blame him? I mean, this movie came a couple of years after his second last James Bond film, Diamonds Are Forever. In between, he only made one movie, which was The Offence. Really fine film. If you want to see a Sean Connery movie from the 1970s, you can't go past The Offence. And he went on to make a number of good films as well. And right in the middle of this streak of good acting films, it's kind of started with things like The Anderson Tapes and went on into The Untouchables in the 1980s, 1990s. There are a whole bunch of good Sean Connery movies in there. There's The Terrorists, Murder on the Orient Express, which is a fantastic ensemble film, The Wind and the Lion, The Man Who Would Be King. He was in A Bridge Too Far, and then he kind of had a dip and went did movies like Meteor, Cuba. He did Outland, which was popular, but was basically just a remake of High Noon. Wrong is Right, which I've talked about on Paleo Cinema podcast as well. Then did his last effort as James Bond, Never Say Never Again, a movie that I have a lot of time for. And then kind of went on to do things like Highlander and The Untouchables, The Presidio, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Russia House, Hunt for Red October, all of those kind of movies. But Zardoz sits in there as a singularly weird film. It's a bit hard to understand that, unless it was for cash flow reasons, why Sean Connery would decide to play a guy in a red jockstrap who goes around on horseback shooting people and raping women and basically acting like a total animal. It's a movie that could never have been made in any other decade except the early 1970s for a number of reasons. And I know this movie has a great cult following, and the fact that it doesn't hold together, that the worldview is crazy, and everybody, except for one or two of the smaller actors like Noah Buggy, are taking themselves too seriously. John Alderton is in the film. Now, John Alderton I knew from a 1960s, 1970s TV series called Please Sir. And he kind of does okay in the film as well. He's a good, honest actor. He wears some really bad aging makeup in the film at one stage. But he comes away successfully. Charlotte Rampling, very fine actor, very beautiful woman, doesn't have a lot to do in this film. Her role is very underwritten, as indeed is Sarah Kesselman. She plays another one of the women. Consuela is a character that Charlotte Rampling plays. And Sarah Kesselman plays May. And both of them kind of do pretty well, given the limited amount of character motivation that they have in this movie. One of the problems with the movie, of course, is the director wrote it as well, and he was just coming off that immense success with Deliverance, and so he could do no wrong according to the studios, and they just let him run with it. And of course, he made a number of good films before that as well, including one of my favourites, Point Blank with Lee Marvin, which, again, I've mentioned in Paleo Cinema podcast and had to talk about that as well. But in this one, Borman does, it's a very pretty film. There's lots of weird and wonderful things going on screen. But it's a light show more than anything else. The philosophy behind the film is very interesting in one point, in that, as indeed Arthur Frayne says at the start of the film, he wants to die. He's been living for 300 years, and he's got this elaborate plot to do with the exterminators and with the Brutals, on how he's going to end his own life and basically stop human beings from becoming immortal, because he sees immortality as a curse, even though he does seem to be having a great time with this great big conceit he's created of Zardoz. Apparently, eternal life is a bore and a nasty thing, and the fact that they're not allowed to die is a big problem for many of the Eternals. So there's a deep and a weird fear of longevity in this film, and also a fear of technology as well. The computer, which has the usual kind of slightly effete computer voice, dominates everybody, and there's no real good reason for that, apart from the fact that it does bestow immortality and lets people live in the vortex and live a kind of agrarian lifestyle, along with David Cronenberg's scanner powers and New Age mind melds and all sorts of other things there, which would, in any reasonable world, make for a very interesting culture. But in this particular film, doesn't make for a very interesting culture at all. It's a little boring. Everybody does things like grinding their own flour, milling their own flour, and basically living an agrarian lifestyle, whereas if I had that technology, I'd be doing things like travelling and enjoying life and going to the bottom of the sea and see what's down there, all this kind of stuff that they could have done. And indeed, there is a scene where one of the characters says they did go to the stars, but they found it boring, which to me is inexplicable, because, you know, if it's boring going to the stars, keep going. There are so many billions and trillions of them out there. Eventually you're going to find something interesting. But apparently not. They got bored and came back to Earth and decided what they were going to do is live in little Irish cottages and grind their own flour. And they also have a singular lack of self-knowledge and self-awareness and what we now call emotional intelligence, because there's a lot of talk among the Eternals about how Zed is a brute and an animal and a beast, and they're going to kill him because he's dangerous and all that kind of stuff. But there doesn't seem to be at all among these people, any one of them, an awareness of the fact that their own policies and their own Arthur Frayne has created this beast of a human being, this bestial man who is all about appetites and violence and all of that. They don't have any awareness of the fact that they created him. And that kind of could be used as a very telling plot point had they chosen to, but no, they don't. They just kind of talk about how he's a bestial thing and how he should be exterminated, and only a few people, like Friend, the character played by John Alderton, kind of go against. But it's like in 300 or 400 years of life, however much these people have, they really haven't learned anything except how to mill flour and how to create religions that give them violent and nasty and brutal and rapacious warriors who ultimately end up being a threat to the Eternals themselves. It's a really fucked up kind of world that is posited in this movie, and it's not a very well thought out one either, which is possibly my main objection to Zardoz. The fact that the world they create is not well thought out at all. It's just a grab bag of traits that don't really stick together in any meaningful or cool way. It's a film director using the baggage and the ideas of science fiction but not knowing what to do with them. It's like Lego, in a sense. I mean, you give a very young child a whole bunch of Lego and they'll clump a whole bunch of shit together and tell you it's a spaceship. And that's pretty much what John Boorman has done with Zardoz. He's clumped together all of the little bricks of different science fiction ideas into a great big blobby mass of stuff. He's got a very good actor. He's got a number of very good actors in there. He's got some beautiful cinematography. He's got some lovely bits of business, and he's just clumped them together and said, here. And that's really is my main objection to the film, that it had the potential to be an interesting and kind of important film even, and genre films can be important, but what Boorman decided to do instead is just piss it away with this stupid idea that immortality is a bad thing and that technological progress is a bad thing and that having the ability to alter the world in unprecedented ways is always going to be a negative thing, and people are going to get bored with living forever, and some of them will go catatonic and some of them will transgress the strict laws of their society and end up being aged as a punishment, which in itself is a nice little trope that you could build a movie around. But in this one, it's just done badly. And that's the problem with a lot of genre films before, I'd say, the 1990s. They don't understand science fiction. They don't understand what it means to make a science fiction film. They don't understand that science fiction at its best is about the impact of change on human beings. And even though there is lip service to this in Zardoz, it really isn't done with any kind of intellectual rigor at all. It's an art student going crazy with a bunch of ideas he read in a magazine. And that's how I feel about a lot of science fiction movies of a certain period or of a certain type. I've got something in me that wants them to be very good. I want every science fiction movie ever to be a brilliant piece of work, or a comedy, or a bit of fun, or something out of the box that's kind of interesting and intriguing and doesn't insult your intelligence at all, which this movie does in several parts. But it doesn't happen. And to have that kind of mindset where I want every science fiction movie to be really fantastic and to surprise me and delight me and educate me and basically give me my money's worth, when a movie like this doesn't, it pisses me off a lot. I mean, at the time I first saw it, when it was in the cinemas in the 1970s, I kind of liked Zardoz to a certain extent. I hated the ending, of course, but I don't know anybody who really doesn't hate the ending of Zardoz. And I liked the fact that I got to see lots of ladies without their clothes on, which in 1974 was something that occupied much of my ratiocination. And my time was taken up with unclad ladies and how interesting they are and how very, 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 very infrequently in my life I saw them. But as an older and slightly wiser person, it's not enough anymore. Yes, it's quite nice, and there are some attractive women unclad in this movie, but I wanted the characters who were unclad to be much more interesting. And Borman didn't give that opportunity to them. Even Sean Connery with his shirt off. I wanted Zed to be a much more interesting character instead of basically the brutal Superman that he is in the film. I'm just going to play the trailer from Zardoz now, and then I'm going to wrap this up. I hope I haven't sounded too negative about it, because I really did want this movie to be a better rewatch for me than it was.
Zardoz speaks to you. His chosen ones, the gun is good. Go forth and kill.
Who came here in the stone head?
I don't know.
It is the only path and passage into the vortex. You will show me how you come to be here. Tell me everything.
My name is Zed. For Zardoz, I am an exterminator.
I'm going to round up and finalise the Zardoz look examination, whatever you want to call it, with the usual Shakespearean movie quote. Tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury signifying nothing. That's pretty much Zardoz. Like 2001, another movie that I have very little time for. It's one of those movies that appears best when you self-medicate. And without the self-medication, you wonder what all the fuss is about. Now, that's pretty much it. I like a lot of the people involved in this film, including Borman, but I think that this one is a self-indulgent and trite and basically philosophically muddy piece of cinema. I know a lot of people like it, and fair enough too. If you look at it in a kind of very frothy and superficial sense, you can get a bit of fun out of it, and you can embrace the campiness of it if you like. It's I'm sure there's any number of cosplayers who have kind of gone down to the gym and then just wrapped a red nappy around themselves and decided to play Zed from Zardoz and a very recognizable and easy to make costume. But yeah, it's one of those movies that is a disappointing what the fuck, in a sense. But as I said, a number of people enjoy the movie, but it annoys me at how clumsy everything is done. So that's about it for Zardoz. I'm sorry if that review pisses people off. If it does, let me know. coldguru@gmail.com. Happy to take on the feedback. But next time around, we're doing the second part of Yucktober, where I'm going to find two other movies that really are pretty yucky and talk about them for a while. So anyway, if you like the podcast, please support it via the Patreon campaign. Go to patreon.com/paleocinema. If you don't, drop me an email at coldguru@gmail.com and tell me you don't. Anyway, in the meantime, everybody, enjoy your film, enjoy television, enjoy the company of friends and family. Just look after yourselves until the next time around. As usual, I will leave you with the credits in the style of movie credits, which name check all of our Patreon subscribers. So take care of yourselves, and I'll be back in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast, and in a week with another Paleo Cinema. Bye for now. And here are the credits for the Patreon subscribers to the podcast in the style of movie credits. I'd like to thank Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah the Special Effects Technician, Ian the Caterer, Grant the Technicolor Consultant, Claire the Script Doctor, Gary the Prop Master, Morris the Musical Director, Jan the Dialect Coach, Armin the Key Grip, Matt the Rattlesnake Wrangler, Elaine our Scientific Advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, our camera operator, Christopher, our gaffer, Miss Jane, our wardrobe mistress, Tansy, the foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, the donut wrangler, Tim, the New York unit director, and Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor. We also have Paul, who does the special makeup effects, and Kathleen, who has yet to have a job in the credits. And Eric, of course, is the set security lead. So thank you to everybody who supports the podcast and to the people who listen to it. If you want to support the podcast with some micropayments, please go to patreon.com/paleocinema, and I'll catch all of you next time.